Kia ora, greetings, and welcome to Green Planet FM 104.6. I'm Tim Lynch, and I trust that you are doing well. I invite you to stay with me over the next hour as we discuss and find ways to take care of our unique and magnificent green planet Earth. As a society, there are a number of keywords in our language that instantly grabs our attention, and as you can imagine, are exploited to maximize every marketing appeal that can be garnished. Yes, sex is one, and money is another, and there's also power. And today we are enmeshed in sex, money, and power, with consciousness ever so slowly emerging in our everyday awareness to take us to the next level of the evolutionary spiral. However, in today's world, we can hold back on sex for a few days or weeks or longer, but when we have no money, we become in many ways debilitated and disempowered. And it is money I want to bring some focus. If we are fortunate to live close to the land or in community, we may be able to live frugally due to support from friends and grow our own food. But back in the real world of a big city and suburbia, making no money can lead to feeling outcast, depressed, and cause family conflict. Fortunately, we here in New Zealand have, by world standards, a very good welfare and safety net system, so no one will ever starve or lack for shelter. However, getting back to money, finances, and economics, when we study and research why we have been led to the abyss with this current financial crisis, we can instantly realize that as a humanity, we have been living in a convoluted world where money has been elevated to the status of God. And we now in so many ways spend most of our lifetime chasing it, paying off things that are quickly becoming obsolescent, as well as paying usury or interest, when in fact, if we realize that we are all related as one global family, we would not be taking advantage of our brothers and sisters, and we would build things to last and loan money free of interest. So here we are, doing our best to keep sane and solvent, whilst there's a perception that there's a giant malaise that has fallen over the Western world. This malaise is resulting in fragmentation, lethargy, stress, and a keep-my-head-down attitude. Where once we had a warmer outlook towards life and each other, the concern now is that of a hardening of attitudes, which is counterproductive to an evolving humanity, growing in consciousness to address the many challenges confronting us so that we can leave our children and grandchildren a planet of peace and goodwill. And speaking of children and the younger generation, many of you may remember a movie that came out about 20 years ago called The Neverending Story. It had a very powerful message that is prophetic and even more relevant today. It tells about the nothing that comes and surrounds the world, and this nothing is quickly coming towards everyone and is devouring everything in its path, leaving nothing but empty space behind it. Do you remember it? It's a kid's classic. The gist of a story led by warm-hearted children is that the only way the nothing can be defeated and turned back is for everyone in the world to open up to their gift of creativity to realize that we can create our way to a better world. This means innovation, inspiration, and intuition, that every human being is capable of an unlimited capacity to change and create a new reality. And in the never-ending story, the children rose to the occasion, with the adults also finally coming to the realization that they needed something like fire in the belly, as well as being light-hearted, they could manifest their individual and collective creative brilliance to obliterate the advances of the nothing, and thus resoundingly defeat it forever. Showing that through creativity, we can create our reality. So when it comes to engaging with money, there's a need for us here in New Zealand, as well as overseas, to realize that we can also create a society that has a currency that can serve the purposes of the community and the betterment of the whole. Thomas Greco is a community and monetary economist, writer and consultant, and a leading global researcher on the subject of free market alternative currency and monetary systems. He is a founder and director of a non-profit community information resource centre, which supports community improvement and sustainability efforts. And British author David Boyle has called Thomas Greco a pioneer in the field of local currencies. Greco's writings are frequently cited by alternative currency advocates. He is frequently a keynote speaker at alternative currency forums around the globe and definitely is a world authority on the need for humanity to awaken to the need to become proactive in this world, and he has recently been in New Zealand on speaking engagements. His latest book, The End of Money and the Future of Civilization, from Chelsea Green Publishers, is now in print. He has two web pages, beyondmoney.net and reinventingmoney.com. That's beyondmoney.net and reinventingmoney.com. He is on the phone from the USA. So kia ora and good morning, Thomas.
Good morning, Tim.
Tom, can you give us a synopsis of the money challenge and how we as a humanity, have become entangled in debt, corruption and deceit? How can we break away from this? Bearing in mind, you most probably have to take us back to the recent history of the advent of the Bank of England.
Yeah, I can do that. The current financial meltdown really comes as no surprise to those who understand the dysfunctional nature of the dominant money system. You see, the system has within it a growth imperative, which is created by the debt imperative. Money today is nothing but credit, and we've allowed our credit to be privatized and to be controlled by a small group. And within the banking fraternity, we have a phenomenon called the central bank. And the story of the central bank goes back to the Bank of England about 300 years ago. The arrangement that was made at that time between the financiers, William Paterson and King William III, was an arrangement by which the king would be able to acquire the funds that he needed to fight his war against France, and in return, the founders of the Bank of England would get the privilege of printing banknotes and lending them into circulation at interest. So you have these twin parasites that were installed within the economy at that time. The two parasites are specifically interest on the debt that is created when money is created from resources upon which the debt is made. And you've got the inflation factor, which is what is caused by the monetization of government debt. This enables governments to spend beyond their tax revenues without regard to current funds that are being raised through taxes. So in the United States, for example, today we have deficits that are running up to over $1 trillion a year. And very few years in our history have shown a budget surplus. And the reason is that the money system, the way it is set up, money can only come into existence by the lending of it into existence by a bank. And the important thing is the basis upon which banks create the money. If they create money on the basis of real bills, for example, commercial bills, which represent the flow of goods and services into the market, that's a legitimate form of money creation. If they create money on the basis of government debt, that brings no additional goods and services to market. So it's like putting counterfeit money into the economy, and you have more money chasing the same amount of goods and services, so you end up with rising prices.
Of course, my concern is that human species is so gullible that we continue to vote, say in the West, for the status quo, and at the same time do not know how our money is being manipulated. Where do you think this breakdown is? Do we trust too much?
I think so. It's sort of a traditional thing that we trust our leaders to do what is in our best interest. But we're seeing evidence now, of course, that sometimes the leadership does not do what's in our best interest, but in the interest of special groups that are well connected. So we have to be realistic about this, and we have to take responsibility for the situation. You know, freedom and responsibility are two sides of the same coin. And unless we take sufficient responsibility for the situation, we're never going to achieve the objectives that we want to achieve. Social justice, economic equity, personal freedom, improved community standard of living. So what we have to do is to, first of all, understand the nature of money, banking, and credit, and to take action necessary to control our own credit. As long as we let a small group control the credit, which is the substance of money today, that credit is going to be allocated in ways that are counter to the public interest and for the benefit of only a small minority. So the important thing is for people to understand how money works. And there have been some good resources recently that have come out that have explained that in ways that people can easily understand it. You know, I started with this 20 years ago with my first book called Money and Debt, A Solution to the Global Crisis. And then in 1994, followed that up with a book called New Money for Healthy Communities. And then in 2001, Money, Understanding, and Creating Alternatives to Legal Tender. And now, most recently, within the last week, my latest book has come out. It's called The End of Money and the Future of Civilization. But there are some good video resources available, too. The Money Masters video came out a few years ago, and that's very good. And also Money as Debt is an animated video that explains very clearly how the money system works and how it malfunctions. So people have to understand this in order to be motivated to take action to improve the situation. Now, what I've been proposing is that we create at the community level exchange alternatives. There's been a lot of talk and a lot of reporting in mainstream media even lately about community currencies and LEP systems and credit clearing systems. And so these things are beginning to gain some traction and gain the attention of even mainstream media. You also have, in the commercial realm, you have the commercial so-called barter exchanges, more appropriately called trade exchanges, because they provide a credit clearing service for business-to-business transactions. The way a trade exchange works is that a trade exchange operator will recruit businesses to join the exchange and provide cashless trading possibilities with other businesses in the community. And the way they do this, of course, is by credit clearing. If you're a business, your purchases are paid for by your sales, simply by keeping a record of transactions. When you sell something, your account is credited. When you buy something, your account is debited. And the idea is that over the long run, your account will fluctuate up and down, but it will fluctuate around zero. Sometimes it will be positive, sometimes it will be negative. So these internal trade credits can be thought of as an internal currency within the exchange. And this is the way we reclaim the credit commons, as I put it, by organizing credit clearing associations. And if you have enough people with enough diversity of goods and services participating in this kind of credit clearing exchange, we can become, to some degree, independent of the political money system.
Now, you mentioned, of course, localized currencies to be more involved in and allow the national currencies to do their vague things. And we can see what's happening now is that they're basically out of control. So to instigate this localized systems, put them in place, I know that Argentina about 6 or 7 years ago went into a collapse and a lot of local systems or currency systems emerged. And then what I have noticed that usually after a while, either central government comes in and clamps down on them and wants to produce a national currency. This is going to be always a challenge, is it not? Do you know what's happening, say, in Argentina, where the people at the grassroots level brought through all these alternative currency systems?
Argentina is a very interesting case, and it's an important one to study. It's true what you say, that governments in the past frequently come down against exchange alternatives, local currencies and the like. We have plenty of examples of that from the Depression era. There were two cases that I mention in two of my books, the case of Schwanenkirchen in Bavaria and Vorgel in Austria. During the Depression, the big problem, of course, was an insufficient supply of conventional money in order for business to continue as usual. And as I said, money is credit. We have the same problem today, by the way. The commercial sector is being starved for credit while the government is being lavishly provided with credit in order to fight wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, in order to maintain bases around the world, in order to bail out the banks. So you have this misallocation of credit that I mentioned before. But going back to government action with regard to local currencies and exchange systems, yes, in both cases, Schwanenkirchen and Vorgel, the government shut them down at the behest of the central banks because they saw them as competition and they wanted to maintain tight centralized control over credit within those countries. In the Argentina case, that was not the problem. In the Argentina case, there were a number of trading clubs, or treque clubs as they called them, that sprouted up from the 1990s, the mid-1990s onward. And this was during a time when the Argentine government was trying to conform to the Washington Consensus and do what the IMF told them to do, which was to maintain parity between the peso and the dollar, to privatize all publicly owned assets. And they did at that time sell off about 4,000 miles of oil and gas pipeline to a subsidiary of the Enron company. And, of course, when the Argentine government disposed of all its publicly owned assets, it had a short-term gain in foreign exchange. But by maintaining dollar-to-peso parity, the new owners were able to take wealth out of the country very quickly, exchanging their peso earnings for dollars and taking dollars out of the country. So eventually, the Argentine government central bank ran out of dollars, and they had to devalue the peso. This caused huge increases in unemployment and tremendous bankruptcies, and the problem went from bad to worse. So in 2002, I believe it was, or the end of 2001, the Argentine economy went into a free fall, and even people who had money in the banks were not allowed to withdraw that money except in small amounts. And there were huge protests. People were out on the streets banging pots and pans, banging on the doors and the walls of the bank buildings, protesting against these actions that were putting people into dire straits. So the alternative or social money movement, as they called it, got a big boost in membership at that time. So people came into the treque clubs and started using these credito currency notes, the local currency notes, in huge numbers, and they were actually a matter of life and death for many people. It was a matter of survival. And when I went to Argentina the first time in 2001, I visited several of these trading fairs, which were going on every day of the week in several different places around Buenos Aires and some of the other places around the country. And hundreds of people would come with their goods, and they would set up to do haircuts and other services, and they would all do these transactions using their own currencies, these credito notes, or papayitos, as they called them, little pieces of paper, which were printed with the names of the bigger treque clubs. And there were three or four dozen different varieties of social money that were circulating at the time. And they tried to network them all together, but they were all being issued on a different basis, and some were a little bit shady and not quite up to snuff as far as transparency is concerned. But anyway, when everybody jumped aboard the Trekkie clubs in 2002, they came in without adequate orientation, and the currencies were being printed in vast amounts and distributed in questionable ways, so that eventually the whole thing collapsed. And it was a combination of naivety, lack of transparency, malfeasance, fraud, and to some extent counterfeiting of the larger circulation social money notes. So it was the errors and the malfeasance of the operators themselves that brought down that system, not any government action. Although some people suspect that it might have been government that was doing the counterfeiting, that's questionable.
So what would be the best way for, say, a New Zealand group or Australians, if they wanted to do this, do they need to have a general meeting across the country or across the region so that they can get some sort of uniformity, to have some boundaries?
Well, it's a massive organizing effort. My proposed approach is based on voluntary association and free market alternatives. And these things can be organized as for-profit businesses, as they are in the commercial barter sector, or they can be organized as mutuals by nonprofit community groups. The way you would go about it is simply you get a few like-minded people together who want to pursue this process. And the way I suggest it be done is by organizing first a mutual credit clearing circle in a local community. And that clearing circle should be a small group of trusted issuers, what I call trusted issuers. And these would be the most popular small and medium-sized, locally owned, locally managed businesses in the community. Because they are the ones that will benefit most from it, and they are the ones whose currency will not be questioned. The mistake that a lot of local community groups make in issuing currencies is they issue the currency to anyone and everyone, and then they hope that the big retailers will redeem it. Well, that's like me spending my IOUs into circulation and then asking somebody else to redeem them for me. The ones that should be issuing a currency are the ones that you want to redeem it. So if you have a local power company or a local telephone company or a large food co-op, they're the ones that should be issuing the currency to begin with. Now, if it's a mutual credit clearing system, you would have two classes of members. You would have, first of all, issuing members, and then other members who must have a positive balance in order to spend. An issuing member is one that can have a negative balance. They can spend before they earn. The other members would have to earn before they spend. So you can organize this association and recruit members throughout the community, starting with the business community. You've got to have a business core in order to make such a system viable. You can't ask people to change their shopping habits too drastically. They want to continue to shop at the places where they've been accustomed to shopping. So those are the ones that you want to recruit into the circle. And local businesses have to be a part of this process from the outset. If they're not, they're not likely to adopt it later on.
Yes, we have a challenge, of course. We don't have a local telephone company per se. There are three large systems from overseas who have come into New Zealand. And even the power companies, they're
boys. Well, I just gave those as an example. There are cities that do have municipally owned utilities like that. But it doesn't have to be a utility. It could be any popular business in the community, food stores, retail merchants of various kinds, movie theaters, anything that's popular and has a substantial business volume.
I see, yes. I am speaking with Thomas Greco from California in the USA. And his latest book, The End of Money and the Future of Civilization, from Chelsea Green Publishers, is now in print. His websites are http://beyondmoney.net and reinventingmoney.com. Thomas, with regard to the different systems, New Zealanders to a degree are aware of the LETS system. And there's, of course, there's time banking as well. One of the difficulties I feel that we don't seem to be excited about this. And, of course, it doesn't get any media exposure whatsoever to inspire people to want to go out and produce their own local currency. And, of course, I have seen some currency notes quite colourful. And, of course, there's the problem, possibly, of counterfeiting further on. What holds people back? Do you think that we've become too complacent?
There are a couple things that hold people back. LETS is a good example of a mutual credit clearing system. The basic process is exactly what we're talking about, where debits and credits are kept track of and purchases are offset by sales. I think the major problems with most LETS systems has been that they have been organized on the basis of ideology by a few people on the fringe, and they haven't involved the mainstream business community. So typically they involve people who have regular jobs, and then they have to find ways to earn LETS credits apart from their regular jobs. So you're recruiting people who are earning credits by avocations, and you're recruiting people who have things to offer that are not basic day-to-day necessities. So that's why I think LETS systems haven't thrived. We had one in Tucson, Arizona, in the early 90s when I arrived there. And it got up to about 30 or 40 members, and there was a modest amount of trading, but never really achieved critical mass, and it gradually faded away. So that's fairly typical. Some LETS systems have gotten much larger than that, with membership in the range of almost 1,000 or more. But again, they have sort of faded away because they haven't involved the mainstream business community. Another thing is that most LETS systems do not impose any limits on account balances. And I think that's a mistake, because if you let account balances get too far into the negative, then people have a hard time ever redeeming their credits, ever getting back to zero. So account balances have to be based on the amount of goods and services that an account sells into the system over a period of time. A rule of thumb that I point out in my books, based on banking experience, is that a line of credit or a negative balance should never be allowed to exceed about 3 months' sales. So, actually, to begin with, probably a much lower limit would be appropriate until enough sales data is accumulated. So, that's one of the problems. Another problem is, until recently, there hasn't been a felt need. The need has been based on ideological and value considerations rather than on economic necessity. Now we're seeing, with the global financial meltdown and increasing unemployment and business bankruptcies, housing foreclosures, people are beginning to feel the pain associated with the dysfunctional monetary and banking system. So now they're beginning to look for alternatives, and I think the time is ripe for people to begin to implement really robust local credit clearing exchanges and local currencies.
Because that's what we need here in New Zealand, and we're starting to feel the impact of what's happening globally. We're more downstream, and it's just taken a bit longer for it to get here. And it's a very key component, because New Zealand was once a country of cooperatives. Mm-hmm. We had cooperatives right across through the dairy industry, through the food growing industry, through the abattoir, And particularly even now, there's kiwi fruit and apple cooperative authorities that are still doing very well. And of course, we've got a large farmers one of 12,500 farmers who are involved with cooperatives. They understand that part, and we used to have a lot of people's banks as well, and they were trust banks right across the country. We had building societies and of course credit unions, but they still don't get really to the core of money. And you mentioned earlier on, particularly when you're here also in New Zealand, about the global commons, that once upon a time water was free, and the fact is that we could virtually travel in most places around the countryside without being fettered. But now everything is becoming monetarized. Where do you think this is leading us, or have you any ideas around that?
Well, that's a whole complex of problems associated with not only the economy but also the political and social aspects of society. The main problem, what I point to, is the privatization of the commons. And this is typically what happens when well-connected people try to pursue their own self-interest at the expense of the common good. The privatization of the commons forces everybody else to pay to gain access. Now, we can go back to the Enclosure Acts in England of several hundred years ago, where land that was commonly owned and used and had open access was decreed to be the property of the lords, and then everybody else was forced to pay to gain access. Or they had to move into the cities and become workers and join the Industrial Revolution. So with the separation of the craftsmen from the tools, with industrialization, we had one major step in the direction of the separation of the economic classes. So privatization of the commons has taken place across the board. It's not only with land, but it's also with the public airwaves and with the credit commons that I like to focus on. So what we have to do is to reclaim the commons to some extent and to allocate access on the basis of our own values and the common interest, instead of the public, instead of the private interests. When it comes to the credit commons, we can do it as I described. New Zealand is an interesting case. As you say, the credit crunch hasn't quite hit New Zealand as quickly as the rest of the world. But we're going through a metamorphic process, I think. You know, like the caterpillar into the butterfly. I think what's happening in society across the globe now is some societal metamorphosis. If you look at the behavior of the caterpillar is inclined to just eat and grow. But at some point, that process comes to an end, and the skin of the caterpillar hardens, and it goes into a phase where the caterpillar body disintegrates, and the imaginal cells that were in the caterpillar body all along become active and start to feed off the nutrient soup of the decaying caterpillar body. And then those imaginal cells join up and multiply and form the new organs of the new butterfly body. And when that process is complete, then the butterfly cracks open the shell and emerges as a new creature. I like to think that that's what we're going through in the world, that humans are going through a metamorphic process similar to that. Up to now, our inclination has been to more and more acquisition, greater despoliation of the natural environment as we consume more and more resources to produce more and more stuff. And interestingly enough, the stuff that we're producing, more and more of it is junk that has short lifetime, and less of it durable products that will last for a long time. I remember when I was young, furniture was made out of solid wood. You very rarely see solid wood furniture anymore. It's mostly particle board with a thin veneer or a plastic wood grain surface. And it has a very short lifetime, and if you get it wet, it's even shorter. So the time between the factory gate, where the product comes out, and the landfill, where the product ends up, is becoming shorter and shorter. So I think we're going through this metamorphic process, and it involves a big shift in economics as well. You know, with the globalization process as it's been carried out, countries have been encouraged to open up their markets for both their products and inputs to production, and to not enforce environmental regulations or regulations relating to work conditions. So it's very difficult now for countries, for example, to exclude products that they deem to be unsafe or questionable. And it's very difficult for countries to compete with the low-wage countries. With this emphasis on trade back and forth, it's gotten to ridiculous extremes where it amounts to taking in each other's laundry. So we see Australian oranges in California and California oranges in Australia. And it's not just a matter of seasonal production patterns. It's a matter of how the most money can be made. Cheap transportation has been one of the enabling factors in this. But I think as we go through this societal metamorphosis, global trade will become less important. We will produce more for our local markets and less for export. We will still have import and export, but only in cases where there is a true comparative advantage, not an artificial advantage.
Because I'm finding that people are wanting to embrace more things. You reduce before you recycle, and you want to make everything as biodegradable as possible, all products. And, of course, the big one, planned obsolescence, it's the big one that we need to be aware of, because we're buying stuff that's breaking down all the time, where fridges could last for 30 years. Now they're lasting 5 to 7 years. And so the human species, in many ways, we're enslaved to wanting to pay off stuff that is breaking down. So we're very keen to be able to look at new ideas. I know that there's, say, Mondragon up in Basque Land in Spain. It's a whole cooperative where they've even got their own bank and their own housing and their own education. And there's about 27,000 people working in this co-op. So there is a group energy, a group focus, where everybody is working for the betterment of the whole. Have you any other examples of where maybe we could look at other smaller banking systems that we could possibly replicate into New Zealand, though working it out for New Zealand conditions?
Well, you raised two questions there, Tim. Let me address these in sequence. First of all is the short-term production of junk related to the growth imperative, and the other is the form of organization looking to Mondragon as a possible model. Let me speak to the first question first. This debt imperative, as I said, drives a growth imperative. Because money is loaned into circulation at interest, every business that's in debt to the bank has to continually increase its markets, increase its sales and profits in order to avoid defaulting on its loans. So this drives the growth imperative. So companies have a very narrow time frame with which to view prospective investments. So they will invest in things that have a quick short-term return. One of the things I learned in business school was discounted cash flow. If you look at the prospective cash flow benefits from a project going out into the future, the value of cash flow out, let's say, 5, 6, 10 years is very small in present value terms compared to the present value of returns in the first, second, third, fourth years. So you discount at a rate of interest or a rate of return sufficient to allow you to pay your interest and service your debt. So it gives planners in business a short time frame. They will not invest in anything that promises benefits far out into the future. They want to invest in things that will have a return very quickly in the near term. So, you know, that's part of the growth imperative and part of the destructive aspect of the current paradigm. So we need to have exchange systems that move beyond this interest burden and move beyond the inflation burden, which I call the twin parasites, in the dominant paradigm. And we can do that with locally organized mutual credit clearing systems and local currencies that are jointly issued by the members of those credit clearing associations. With regard to Mondragon, this gets into the organizational aspects. And I write about all of this in my latest book, by the way, The End of Money and the Future of Civilization. I use Mondragon as an example. The Mondragon cooperatives started more than 50 years ago in the Basque region of northern Spain. And this was in the aftermath of the Franco regime coming to power, the fascist regime in Spain, and maintaining a pretty tight rein on the Basques because they had supported the opposition to Franco during the Civil War. But they managed, in spite of all these difficulties, to begin to create a new kind of economy for their region. And this started with industrial cooperatives that were worker-owned and producing consumer goods that were in demand in the market. After these 50 years, the Mondragon Cooperative Corporation is the head of this cooperative association, and they have over 120 cooperative companies, including the largest supermarket chain in Spain, and they have a cooperative bank which supports the financing needs of existing cooperatives and new cooperatives, and they also have a Mondragon University and facilities for retraining workers when a cooperative needs to produce new products or get into a new line of business. So this is an important case to study. There's also a phenomenon in northern Italy that I didn't write about in the book, but there's been quite a bit of documentation on it. It's the Emilia-Romagna flexible manufacturing networks. There are a number of small businesses in that region of northern Italy that cooperate on projects on an ad hoc basis. They will join together to take on a project that none of them can handle by themselves. And this apparently is based on a foundation of social capital, as it's called, a long history of social organization for mutual benefit in many different areas of life in that region of Italy. So that's another case that merits further research. I think one of the important factors in maintaining control is the scale of operations. Malcolm Gladwell, in his book, The Tipping Point, talks about the rule of 150. And he mentions that when an organization becomes larger than 150 people, the social dynamics change drastically. It's only in small groups that people feel empowered, that they feel that they can have an influence over what the group does and how the group operates. And he gives an example of the Gore Company, the company that produces Gore-Tex outwear equipment and clothing. They have a policy of not allowing any factory to grow bigger than 150 workers. If they need to expand production beyond that, they will start another unit to take that on instead of expanding the size of an existing unit. They also have a flat hierarchy. Everybody's called an associate. They each have their own responsibilities, but there's not a lot of management hierarchy of people telling other people what to do. They operate more on the basis of deliberation and agreement. So I think historically we've seen that many cooperatives lose sight of the cooperative values that they were based on originally, and they become captive of a small group of self-perpetuating management. I've seen that happen in credit unions in the United States, where the membership eventually becomes disempowered and the management is self-perpetuating in-group that operates the credit union more for their own benefit than for the benefit of the members. So I think it's important to keep units, organizational units, down in size to less than 150 people, maybe even considerably less, and then network those together in a way that keeps the power at the bottom of the pyramid, so to speak. And an important aspect of that is that when power is delegated to some higher level, that there should be the possibility of instant recall if the one to whom power has been delegated fails to carry out the wishes of the group. So that's my vision for the organizational aspect of Mutual Credit Clearing Network, is that you have small affinity groups networking together within a community, across a region, and eventually nationwide.
And Thomas, what would your vision be? I mean, we've got things sort of telescoping inwards time-wise, things getting faster and faster, and there's the three challenges of ecological, financial, and social coming as three ways to virtually hit each other. Do you see a network of consciousness, of change, bursting through? And do you have a vision relating to this? Because we all want to see a planet come into realization that we are one global society or global family. And, of course, children need to have a future which they can look forward to. Have you got a vision that you would like to let out?
Yes, my vision is for a convivial society, as Ivan Illich put it. It's a society where our beliefs are based on a belief in abundance and sufficiency, where cooperation becomes more important than competition, where the common good is more important than individual limited self-interest, where people are willing to work together in order to bring about a better quality of life throughout the community. And as I said, there are social, political, and economic aspects to all of this, and with environmental implications as well. I see the key to all of it as reclaiming the credit commons, that is, taking the initiative to organize the exchange process on a mutual credit clearing basis. And I think once we achieve that, the rest of it will tend to fall into place. It will make the other problems more easily tractable. So my suggestion to any group in any community would be to begin a dialogue process that involves all aspects of the community, especially the business, mainstream business community, but also faith groups, religious communities, social groups of various kinds. Get people talking to one another to come to some realization that our fate is a common fate and we need to pay greater attention to the common good. Once we organize the credit clearing association and have our own localized methods of facilitating transactions, economic transactions, then I think people will see the potential of cooperating in other aspects of community life. I have a 5-stage plan for economic development that I presented in New Zealand just a couple weeks ago, and that can be found in my new book, The End of Money and the Future of Civilization.
And your websites again, please?
The website is reinventingmoney.com, and my blog is beyondmoney.net. Reinventingmoney.com, and my blog is beyondmoney.net.
And are you coming back to New Zealand?
Well, I hope to come back to New Zealand someday, but I don't have any immediate plan. We'll just see what happens.
Very good. Well, Thomas, I'd say thank you so much for sharing of your expertise.
You're most welcome, Tim.
Money is always, it's always on people's minds, isn't it? When in actual fact, it should be just a means to bring goods and services together without us having to make this killing.
Well, money has become our master, and it should be our servant. We need to turn it back to being a servant.
Excellent. I thank you once again, Thomas.
Thank you, Tim.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
That was Thomas Greco from the United States speaking on money, currencies, and economics. He has two web pages, beyondmoney.net and reinventingmoney.com. That's beyondmoney.net and reinventingmoney.com. I'd like to finish from David Corton's classic bestseller, The Great Turning, From Empire to Earth Community. You may remember his book of 10 years ago, When Corporations Rule the World. Well, things are changing again, and he has emerged with one of the most well-researched publications on where we, as a collective humanity, can quite possibly successfully navigate as a dynamic, high-energy, conscious planetary civilization. So what name will our children and our children's children call our time? Will they speak in anger and frustration of a time of a great unraveling when profligate consumption led to an accelerating wave of collapsing environmental systems, violent competition for what remained of the planet's resources, a dramatic dieback of the human population, and a fragmentation of those who remained into warring fiefdoms ruled by ruthless local lords? Or will they look back in joyful celebration on the noble time of the Great Turning, when their forebears turned crisis into opportunity, embraced the higher order potential of their human nature, learned to live in a creative partnership with one another and the living earth, and brought forth a new era of human possibility? It is the premise of a great turning from empire to earth community that we humans stand at a defining moment that presents us with an irrevocable choice. Our collective response will determine how our time is remembered for so long as the human species survives. In the days now at hand, we must each be clear that every individual and collective choice we make is a vote for the future that we of this time will bequeath to the generations that follow. The great turning of humanity as a dynamic, co-creative community on a global scale is not a prophecy, it is a possibility. It is now within our means to make an epic choice to put the sorrows of empire behind us in favor of the joys of Earth community. We have the knowledge and the technology. The remaining barriers are primarily self-limiting beliefs that have no reality beyond the human mind. The explosive advance of human knowledge in the past 100 years greatly expands not only our understanding of our nature and possibilities, but also the capacity for cooperative self-organization and mutual service inherent in the very nature of life itself. To navigate successfully the turbulent waters of the Great Turning, we must revisit and update the stories by which we communicate our common understanding of our human origin, purpose, and possibility. That was from David Corden's new book, The Great Turning. So what on earth do we want for ourselves and our family? It has to be fresh, clear, unpolluted air. Pure, vital, non-chemically treated water. Healthy, tasty, organic, whole food. That's what I like to affirm, and I encourage you to affirm it too. Plus cooperation and community. We need to find ways to peacefully work and play together. So I wish to affirm that too, and again, with your assistance. There are also many other aspects, from satisfying occupations to safe and affordable housing and transport, education, health and leisure, So let's affirm that also. These are the baseline ideals that greenplanetfm.com sets out to encourage and espouse. For when we communicate, decide to network. Use every letter you write, every email you send, every conversation you have, every meeting you attend to express your fundamental beliefs and dreams. Affirm to others the vision of the world you want. Network through thought. Network through action. Network through love. Network through the spirit. You are the center of a network. You are the center of the world. You are a free, immensely powerful source of life and goodness. Affirm it. Spread it. Radiate it. Think day and night about it, and you will see a miracle happen. The greatness of your own life in a world of big powers, media, and monopolies. And of 6.5 billion individuals, networking is the new freedom, the new democracy, a new form of happiness. That was by Dr. Robert Muller, Chancellor of the World Peace University, Costa Rica, and Central America. Here at greenplanetfm.com, this program aims to communicate and talk about environmental solutions, to mobilize consciousness to the many challenges that surround us and those unseen over the horizon. Subjects that we here in New Zealand need to be willing to discuss in the public arena, especially through mainstream media, over the dinner table, in cafes, pubs and bars, and more openly debated within our parliamentary democracy here. And by talking, thinking and brainstorming solutions and remedies, we can support the kids of today and tomorrow, as well as the ideal of a sustainable future. And let's face it, these little kiddies running around at knee height, looking up at us with love in their eyes, deserve to have a future where they can live to enjoy the beauty of life, as well as fulfill all of their inner potential and dreams. And if you want to contact me by email, I am tim@ourplanet.org. But better still, phone the station here at 815-8600, 815-8600, and let them know that you are listening. This way, you support what this voluntary program is doing. Meanwhile, don't forget to support your local health and whole food stores like Harvest and Greylin, Huckleberry and Green Lane, Ceres and Ellerslie, East West and Earthseed Organics out west, IE Produce in Takapuna, and of course, the Eco Store in Freemans Bay. If you are looking for a New Zealand magazine that covers all aspects of complementary, traditional, and alternative health, I suggest Healthy Options at www.healthyoptions.co.nz. This always interesting holistic publication comes out monthly and is full of healthy hints and articles to keep our body, mind, and spirit flowing at optimum levels. That's healthyoptions.co.nz. And if you wish to visit www.greenplanetfm.com, you can learn a little more of the overview of this program, as well as peruse the weblog. Wishing you a wonderful week, I look forward to being with you again next Thursday at Green Planet FM 104.6, same time, 8 to 9 a.m., when I interview another unique person assisting in shaping our future on Earth. This is Tim Lynch, and Mobilizing Consciousness, saying Hari Rā.